From Maine to New Mexico, Missouri to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Biden's proposal for massive new spending on infrastructure comes with a wide range of new and increased taxes to pay for it. Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform is here with details. Democrats are moving forward with plans to pack the Supreme Court of the United States with left-wing justices. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. As the federal government borrows and prints trillions of dollars, the threat of inflation looms. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why. And despite media portrayal and woke disinformation, Georgia's new election law is actually reasonable and returns integrity to the process. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Joe Biden has proposed a wide-ranging so-called infrastructure bill that goes way beyond the traditional definition of infrastructure of things such as roads and bridges. He's also asking for new and significantly higher taxes to pay for it. Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform. He is here to break down what the president's tax proposals will mean to you. Grover, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Grover, the president has proposed a wide range of new and additional and increased taxes as part of his so-called infrastructure bill. Can you give our listeners an overview as to what sort of taxes the president is proposing?
Yes. And just as the COVID bill had very little to do with COVID, the infrastructure bill has very little to do with infrastructure, if by infrastructure you think they mean roads, bridges, airports, waterways. This is a spending bill and a tax bill, with maybe 6% dealing with roads, bridges, and transportation. So you're quite right to say, let's get to the heart of the matter, tax increases. He wants to take the corporate income tax, which is 21% now, up to 28%. Sometimes he says 35%. It may negotiate up from 28%, but he goes at least to 28%. What does that mean? Well, we had the largest, highest income, corporate income tax in the world when he was vice president with Obama, 35%. Communist China was at 25%. So get some sense. European average, low 20s. We had the highest. If you wanted to invest in the United States, you were paying the highest tax rate in the world, higher than China. President Trump and the Republicans took that down to 21%. And now what Biden says he wants to do is take the corporate rate back up to at least 28%, maybe 35%. During the campaign, he said 35%. But at least to 28%, which would make our corporate rate higher than every other countries in the world, make us non-competitive. But what does that mean for you? Well, if you pay utilities for like electricity and natural gas, your utility bills will go up. Why is that? When you have a corporate income tax on public utilities, and that is passed directly on to consumers. The utility does not pay the corporate income tax. You do. And by law, it's just passed straight through to you. So when the Republicans cut the corporate income tax, billions of dollars in lower utility bills for the entire United States, 90% of Americans get their utilities from a for-profit company which pays taxes, saw their utility bills go down from where they would be. Now they will go up. So your utility bill will go up. Two, if you are one of the 53% of households in the United States, more than half. Remember, he always says he's only going to smash 1%. Half of American households have a 401k or an IRA, and they're invested in stocks. Well, when you have a higher corporate income tax, the value of the company goes down. Why is that? Well, because the after-tax cash flow, net cash flow goes down, the value of the stock goes down, the value of the company goes down, and the value of your life savings inside your individual retirement account or 401k goes down. So 90% of Americans will get hit with higher utility bills because taxes, and half of the country will see their life savings damaged directly, more than that indirectly, but directly with the higher corporate rate. He also wants to have a tax on energy. That's a gasoline tax. That is a tax on electricity. It's a tax on all energy that is created by non-subsidized industries. That hits almost every single American who drives a car. 1% of Americans, very rich people, have a subsidized tax credit supported electric car. That's nice for them to get the rest of us pay for their much of their car. It's electric, but of course, at some point, that electricity is produced by real energy, and that gives you the situation of a higher tax even on that car as well. He also wants to increase the death tax and have a second death tax called eliminating the step-up in basis. If you get a house or a business or land or a farm from a parent, they want to tax you immediately on the capital gain during your father or mother's life. And you may not have the cash. You may have to borrow it. You may have to sell the house in order to pay the tax. And then again, another death tax on top of that. So there are a whole series of taxes that are headed right for you. Oh, I didn't mean to forget the Obamacare penalty tax. That is the tax the 5 million Americans were paying during the Obama years, 3/4 of whom earned less than $50,000 a year. So this is a tax on middle-income, lower-income people. And he promised to bring that back to hit at least 5 million Americans again. They were not hit during the Republican presidency because the Republican Congress took that number to zero. Biden says he's going to bring it back. So there isn't anyone in America who will not pay higher taxes because Biden infrastructure tax hike.
The president, of course, Grover, has been saying this is going to help create more and new jobs throughout the country as a result of this so-called infrastructure bill, which, as you pointed out, has actually very little to do with infrastructure. Given all these taxes that you've just outlined that are going to go up, how in the world is that going to create more jobs? Sounds to me like it would go the opposite direction and cause businesses to pull back and hire less.
When Biden was vice president with Obama, we saw American corporations inverted. They were either bought by foreign businesses or they became foreign businesses. They moved their headquarters and their where they legally were incorporated. Why? Because we had higher taxes than they did. As soon as the Republicans took the corporate income tax down, those inversions stopped. That stopped happening. We are going to go back to where countries invert to avoid the higher taxes in the United States. And sometimes they say, well, we'll hunt them down and we'll chase after them and we'll punish them if they leave. Well, you know what that means? That means other companies won't start here. You don't create a company in the United States if you think that you are going to be stuck there even as taxes go up and you don't have a chance to leave. If you don't go into a room that you're not allowed to leave. So you will see that in companies not being started in the United States, investment flowing to other countries where you're allowed to pick up and move, freer countries like communist China, for crying out loud. I mean, to be more destructive of business than a socialist China strikes me as really not the direction we want to go in. And what will this do to wages? We know that when we cut the corporate income tax in 2017 and 2019, three years later, 17, 18, 19, what you had was a $4,440 increase in the median income for Americans.
We have been talking with Grover Norquist, who is president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, tell us just a little bit about Americans for Tax Reform and where can folks go to read more about this and other topics that ATR works on?
Americans for Tax Reform, our website is atr.org. I tweet at Grover Norquist. And I forgot to mention they're going to double the capital gains tax, have a tax on guns, and also ban the gig economy, ban independent contractors. So those are that's not even a tax. That's just destroying jobs.
It certainly is. Well, Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has had a busy week. There are policy developments. There are political developments. We are going to talk about all of them with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the political activities, although this might be considered political as well, Joe Biden is moving forward to at least foster a discussion on the possibility of expanding, actually packing, the Supreme Court of the United States. Would you fill our listeners in, Scott, on the developments in that area this past week?
I'm sure all the listeners remember Donald Trump working with the United States Senate and the Senate majority from the Republicans to confirm Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Gorsuch, and more recently, last fall, Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And that gave so-called conservative majority to the Supreme Court. And we know that the liberals in Congress and throughout the country felt like that seat that Ruth Bader Ginsburg held for so long really belonged to the liberals. And so they were fuming when Donald Trump in an election year went forward with Mitch McConnell in advancing the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. So there's been a lot of talk over the last several months about whether or not the Democrats would consider packing the court if they obtained unified government. And of course, you know, in January when we saw Democrats win both those seats in Georgia in the United States Senate races, they do have a 50-50 Senate with Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker. And the Democrats now are trying to effectuate change when it comes to the way that our separation of powers are really governing the American people through the judiciary and through the legislative branch and through a probably a weaker than ever executive branch with Joe Biden as president. We're also seeing the Biden administration saying that they would prefer to have a new commission. But if you remember, Joe Biden in the 80s said that it was a boneheaded idea, a terrible mistake to make, and that you shouldn't put into question the independence of the most significant body, including the Congress in his view, which is the Supreme Court. And so a boneheaded idea 40 years ago is also a boneheaded idea now. I don't think that just because Republicans in the United States Senate worked with Donald Trump to confirm Supreme Court justices that we need to dramatically change the way that the Supreme Court is constructed. And going from 9 seats to 13 seats create a political situation in Washington where you could kiss everything else goodbye. Everything would screech to a halt in terms of Senate minority with Mitch McConnell and Republicans forcing quorum calls on all the really simple unanimous consent things that the Senate usually processes, including like the reading of legislation and the way that they convene and adjourn. Everything, I think, would change in the way that Republicans posture themselves in the minority if Democrats went forward with packing the Supreme Court. So we also even heard former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid this week sort of throw cold water on the fire of the idea to pack the Supreme Court. He said that he would urge extreme caution in moving forward with a proposal like that. And he actually thinks that Biden's commission will not recommend expanding the court. But this is all part of the radical left. We know that Ed Markey is the Senate co-sponsor of the Green New Deal. Well, he's the lead on this idea to pack the Supreme Court from 9 to 13 justices, too.
In addition to the Supreme Court news this past week, we have a major retirement announcement. Congressman Kevin Brady, a former chairman and member of the Ways and Means Committee. Scott, what was at play in the congressman's decision, and what impact does this have on the 8th Congressional District in Texas?
Kevin Brady was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee when the House Republicans moved forward with President Trump on passing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which is the largest tax cut in American history. He served 13 terms in the United States House of Representatives and is always respected as one of the kindest members in the House Republican Conference. So it is a big loss, but this is pretty standard. Kevin Brady became chairman in 2015 when Paul Ryan stepped away from the Ways and Means Committee in order to be the speaker after John Boehner left. And obviously John Boehner's been making some news around the country with his new book, Trashing Ted Cruz. A little bit of an aside, we obviously think Ted Cruz is a great senator and a champion for economic freedom. So getting back to Kevin Brady, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a very, very good pro-growth measure. I think one of the best accomplishments of the Trump administration working with a House majority and a Senate majority to enact that law. But Republicans have conference rules that dictate how long you can be leading a committee, and Kevin Brady's term limited as the top Republican on the committee, so he'll be stepping down from that position at the end of this Congress. and he will not run for re-election in 2022.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our members are united in the idea of economic freedom and liberty in a constitutionally limited federal government. And so if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. We're also on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When governments borrow and print too much money, the inevitable result is inflation. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says that threat is now on our horizon.
As America exits the COVID-19 pandemic, demand for goods and services is surging, and that means prices are increasing, and that means that we've got new worries about inflation. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a close look at the inflation risk on the heels of some news this past week showing that the consumer price index has climbed dramatically in the past year. But some experts say that the real inflation risk is not coming from the markets, but rather coming from our political culture. The consumer price index for the month of March did show a 2.6% increase over the same month last year. That's the largest year-to-year increase in prices since the summer of 2018. And that's a big part of the reason why people are now talking about inflation as a possibility. It's also a significant increase from where the consumer price index was just a few months ago. It's about double where things were a few months ago. Meanwhile, the White House Council of Economic Advisors warned this past week that measured inflation is likely to increase over the next few months. And perhaps the most obvious signal of rising prices, at least for the vast majority of Americans, people who don't have advanced degrees in economics or pay close attention to what the, you know, White House Council of Economic Advisors says, the most obvious signal for most people is the price of gasoline. And that has been steadily marching upwards as well since the start of the year. So does all this mean that we're heading for a return to the 1970s when rampant inflation caused widespread economic turmoil? David Beckworth, a former Treasury Department economist and senior fellow at the Mercatus Center, told me this week that the panic is probably a bit premature for now. He says that the economic indicators aren't flashing any major red alerts, but that the political economy is more worrying. So let's take those points one at a time. One of the best indicators of future inflation is something called the break-even inflation rate, which measures the difference in yield between bonds that are pegged to inflation and bonds that are not. And the five-year break-even inflation rate, in other words, how much inflation investors are anticipating over the next 5 years, has been increasing in recent months, but it's basically just a little bit higher than its normal average, its pre-recession average. Right now, investors are saying that they expect inflation to average about 2.5% over the next 5 years. Now, that's significant, but certainly not catastrophic, certainly not a problem for the country. In short, if there is runaway inflation on the horizon, investors, the people who actually have skin in the game, aren't anticipating it. And even if inflation does spike a bit in the short term, for reasons that we'll talk about in just a minute, it doesn't appear that there will be a big long-term spike, and it could be a short-term spike that comes right back down, so that the average over the next 5 years sits at that 2.5% rate that investors are now expecting. So what about the rising consumer price index? That's also a concern, but maybe not a major one. Because what the consumer price index does is it looks backwards, right? It compares prices today to where they were a year ago. And it's right now capturing a lot of the economic weirdness that was created by the pandemic last spring. In short, March of 2020 was not a normal month. So when you're looking at March of 2021 versus March of 2020, well, you're going to get some funky numbers. During the spring and early summer of last year, a lot of prices actually fell across the economy because demand sank as much of the country entered lockdown. The biggest contributor to the rising consumer price index in March, for example, are the surging gasoline prices. Gasoline is up 22% from where it was a year ago. But that says as much about last spring's drop in gas prices due to the sudden glut in supply as people stop traveling and commuting, as it does about where things sit right now. Certainly, again, cause for some concern, but probably more of like a trick of the light than it is anything else. And now that the economy is well underway, demand is surging and prices are rising, and so some inflation is to be expected as the economy comes out of the COVID recession anyway. But again, that's a short-term situation that is likely to work itself out, not a long-term increase in prices that would wreck standards of living and long-term retirement plans, things like that. That's the type of inflation that has to be avoided or should be avoided, if at all possible. Now, that's the economic side of the inflation story, and it should provide some comfort. The political side of the story, though, is a little bit different. And Beckworth tells me that what he thinks will ultimately cause inflation to take off is a sustained increase in the growth of government spending. If the government continues to do these big spending packages and there's not an immediate increase in inflation, that enables everyone, but especially policymakers, to be more complacent about future government growth. In short, he says it might be fair to worry that inflation actually isn't high enough right now. The federal government just pumped $1.9 trillion in deficit spending into the economy in March. Now the Biden administration is proposing permanent increases to the baseline federal budget and pushing for a $2.3 trillion infrastructure package. Even without those spending increases, deficits were already set to grow in coming years, largely because entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare run on autopilot, and Congress isn't going to reduce any of the spending in many other programs either. So all of that is happening at a time when both major parties have abandoned just about any pretense of concern about overspending or the size of deficits or the size of government. And so the alarm bell of rising inflation might really be the only check on the political incentives that keep the cost of government growing. The problem is the alarm bell isn't ringing, at least not yet. So are we heading for higher inflation in the coming months? Yes, probably true. Prices will go up throughout the summer as demand surges and the economy recovers from COVID-19. People get back to work and back to doing all the things that they like to do in their leisure time as well. But long-term inflation risk isn't really there at the moment. At least investors don't think it is, and economists are somewhat mixed on the idea too. But the problem could be that the political culture that we've created over the last few years, and particularly in response to the pandemic, is only going to feed that inflation risk in the years to come. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the economy, the recovery, everything going on in Washington, D.C. at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Despite the controversy, Georgia's new election law will restore integrity to that state's electoral process. Colin Hanna of Led Freedom Ring USA explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I don't know of any current political issue that has prompted more disparate treatment of the intent of a law than the recently passed Georgia voting reform law. Both sides use the term voting reform, but look at how Michelle Cottle of the New York Times editorial board defined it just this past week. For Democrats, she said, voting reform means making ballot access easier and encouraging maximum participation. Republicans want to go in the opposite direction, with measures that risk hitting minority voters especially hard. Notice how the perspective of Democrats is couched. Making ballot access easier and encouraging maximum participation. Don't those two claims sound like the very essence of fairness? And does the phrase hitting minority voters especially hard sound inherently evil? Let's rewrite Ms. Cottle's definition. How about this? For Republicans, voting reform means ensuring that all votes counted are valid, by ensuring that fraudulent votes from non-citizens are not included in the vote count, and that only one vote is counted from each legitimate voter. Democrats want to go in the opposite direction, with measures that eliminate voter validation and increase the unsupervised collection of votes spread over many days. Could those two vastly differing descriptions accurately describe the same piece of legislation, or is one of them demonstrably more accurate than the other? The claims made by the critics and the defenders of the Georgia law are just as disparate. Are the claims of one side demonstrably more accurate than the claims of the other? President Biden's choice of words to describe the bill provoked the most intense racialization of the debate when he called it Jim Crow on steroids. My friend Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Treasurer and Secretary of State, says that claiming voter ID is a form of voter suppression is a smokescreen designed to muddle the debate. Instead of debating the merits of voter ID and election regulations, liberals label them and anyone supporting them as racist in attempts to shut down any debate. The data doesn't matter. The views of African Americans and Latinos don't matter. The actual text of the new law doesn't matter. The hyperbolic rhetoric ignores the truth. Washington Post columnist Henry Olson provided a thoughtful and unemotional analysis when he wrote, "Democrats have been tarnishing Georgia's new voting law, saying it represents a return to Jim Crow. That calumny besmirches an effort that largely succeeds at balancing extensive voter access with strong election integrity. Jim Crow was a heinous system that systematically denied Black Americans their constitutional right to vote through bogus literary tests, poll taxes, and other measures such as whites-only Democratic primaries in states where Democrats were sure to win. Backed by racist law enforcement and threats of violence or lynching by the Ku Klux Klan and similar groups, even Black people who were able to vote often chose not to. The new Georgia law does nothing to return the state to this terrible time. Black voters will still be able to register without hindrance." End of Henry Olson's commentary. Democrats charge that some of the law's provision will have a differential impact on Black voting and thus demonstrate prejudicial intent. These provisions include requirements that voters present a photo ID when voting in person, that those voting by mail provide their driver's license number or the last four digits of their Social Security number. None of these provisions should prevent anyone from voting, and many are popular even among Black voters. Olson concludes by citing that 63% of Black respondents favor voter ID. He says that Democrats' objections are an answer in search of a problem. When one side of a debate appeals to facts and actual legislative provisions, and the other appeals to raw emotions and stirs up fear, the truth is more likely found in the former. Donald Trump too often employed the latter, and Democrats rightly excoriated him for it. In the criticism of the Georgia voting law, the parties have ironically reversed roles. Jim Crow on steroids, it is not. And President Biden should apologize to the American public for using such inflammatory language. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KYND-AM in Belleville, Texas, WLNX-FM in Lincoln, Illinois, along with WAAI-FM and WZZU-FM in Lynchburg, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.